at session number 12502, and this is reel 17.
Field Marshal Lord Bramall, reel 17. I think you were telling me about the political background to your taking up the post of Chief of General Staff in 1979.
Yes, well, of course, we had high expectations. The pay had been got right. The run-out had been stopped. Morale was very good. And so we had high expectations that we would be able to improve our general efficiency all the way around. And of course we got a rude shock as far as money was concerned, because almost immediately after the election the Treasury demanded a cut of some £250 million, I think, and the pressure from then was of course was enormous. And so we found ourselves in a time when all sorts of other things were going slightly unusually, at an unusual pace. That is to say, the aiming off that people did for the slowness of arrival for equipment. We suddenly found that we were in a recession, as bad as the one we've just had, but we were in a recession, and so we used to make block adjustments to allow for industry not producing the thing quite on time. And the tradition, historically, there had always been an underspend the money. Well, suddenly we were getting two things happening. First of all, because of the recession, everything was coming faster, so the block adjustments were wrong. And secondly, we were actually getting the cash reduced from the Treasury. And so for the first time, instead of getting an underspend problem, we were suddenly threatened with a tremendous overspend problem. And with Mrs. Thatcher determined to see that costs and everything else were cut down, government expenditure was cut down, we suddenly found ourselves in a terribly difficult position. Now, as we might have realised, this thing gradually worked itself through, but everybody panicked. We had to have a moratorium on everything, which had taken quite a time to work itself through, and of course this affected spare parts, track mileage, all these other things, which came out of the only areas which you could get your hands on. And you've got a certain amount of cynicism in the army, saying, well, you know, this lot is just as bad as the other lot, really. I mean, you know, we're not getting all the things we hope to get. So that really drifted on from 79, really, till about the time of the Falklands, or the time of the John Knott Review, which was just before the Falklands, of course.
One interesting thing, actually, you say in the book that I'd like to explore, you say that when the Treasury was exerting its pressure, the Army and the Royal Air Force had their commitments to NATO to use to peg their air force level so they could defend themselves, and that the Navy could not rely upon such commitments. But surely the Navy had its commitments to Sackland and to the Northeast Atlantic to give it some ground on which to defend its force levels and its capabilities.
Well, you're quite right. I mean, it did have that. That is true. And it was a bit of an open-ended commitment. I mean, the Sackland wanted more and more stuff.
You never have enough anti-submarine warfare capacity, can you?
No, or escorts or anything else. And but it was largely a matter of opinion. I mean, did Sackland want as much as he said he did? Was this the best way of going about it? The opinion came into this. Whereas in Germany, you had a set piece of frontage And, you know, you couldn't argue that you needed less troops to hold that bit of frontage.
It was more concrete.
Was more concrete. I think this was the thing.
And you mentioned the Treasury and Mrs. Thatcher. Where do you think the actual impetus to try and control inflation by cutting costs came from? Was it personal from Mrs. Thatcher, or was it?
Well, it was an alliance of the two, because, of course, the Treasury would have always taken this view and had done historically right the way through the whole of the century, so to speak. So, but there was Mrs. Thatcher on top of them, not trying to break away from it, but actually reinforcing what they wanted. So this was a very, very powerful element indeed. And, of course, the trouble was that Francis Pym found himself in an impossible position. He didn't think there was justification for doing away with any major items of equipment or cutting the programme. And he thought the chiefs of staff were right about this. She was insisting that he cut the costs very considerably. He didn't have an enormous enthusiasm for financial management, as people like Heseltine or Knott may have done. And he didn't think there was a case, so he dragged his feet, and as a result, relationship between him and Mrs. Thatcher got worse and worse.
They differed on other matters.
And eventually
They did differ on other matters as well, though, didn't they?
Well, they differed matters on a lot fundamentally. But, I mean, you know, it was a combination of these things. So Knott was put in to clear up the Stygian stables of waste that she thought existed in the Ministry of Defence. And he cast around to see where it could happen. And much against the wishes of the General Staff, I said, look, we must be absolutely candid on this. We will volunteer a much reduced Rhine army. We will say this is one of the options. We won't volunteer it. We'll say this is one of the options. That you have a small, rather like they're going for now, a small corps in reserve, which will get us off the hook of forward defence, make our reinforcement easier, and will save a considerable amount of administrative backing and so on. We could do this. The disadvantages will be who is going to fill our gap and so on. I mean, I was pretty certain that with the climate then, they wouldn't accept this. But I thought that if we were to offer this, John Knott would feel we were being utterly candid. And the Air Force didn't have a problem because they could always change the label on their aircraft. I mean, if the strategy was going to be maritime, they could say their aircraft flew over the sea. And if it was continental, they said it flew over the land. We were much more vulnerable because historically, England have always felt for the Navy. But you see, the Navy made the mistake of saying to Knott, it's none of your business, Secretary of State. We tell you what sort of fleet you need. There are no other options. We need a balanced fleet. We want to be able to do A, B, C, and D. And it may happen. And he didn't accept that. He said, all we have to interest in, all we're concerned in, is fighting within the NATO concept, anti-submarine warfare in the Norwegian Sea. And for that, surface ships are a liability, over-vulnerable, and we want less surface ships and more submarines, and all these old amphibious ships and carriers, they're all a thing of the past. And he took this view, and of course no sooner had he taken it than we operated the one campaign which the Navy said have to be prepared to do, and everyone else said would absolutely beyond our means, operate 8,000 miles at home from an area where the air cover could not be provided from land-based aircraft. So such are the pitfalls of a Secretary of State who tries to take a major change in direction.
It has been said that the Navy were actually relying upon their traditional popularity rather than on close argument.
Well, they didn't rely on any argument at all. This was one of their problems. They were saved, of course, by the Falklands. But they didn't rely on that, and I suppose to that extent, they thought that and there was a certain amount of leaking to the public, they thought that the public would say, look, this is terrible. Although the Navy is about to go down considerably below what John Knott envisaged.
Because they did put, I think they did portray themselves to a certain extent as a sort of dark blue insurance company, didn't they, against unforeseeable risk.
Yes, I mean, this is what they said. They said you must have a balanced fleet. You may have to operate anywhere. You may have to project power anywhere. And John Knott said, I'm only interested in NATO.
There was a certain amount of press activity about the survey ship in the South Atlantic, wasn't there?
Yes, well, that was one of the many signals that we sent, that we were not interested in the Falklands or what happened. I mean, mind you, we tried to get rid of the Falklands. A number of ministers had gone down there. They'd produced all sorts of plans for getting rid of the Falklands, handing over sovereignty and lease back and all these other things. But, of course, they couldn't get it through Parliament. That's why the talks were in limbo. I mean, if they'd had half the chance, the Conservative administration would have, when Carrington was... and indeed the Labour Party before that, but both governments had tried to get rid of the Falklands, but there was a certain amount of pressure from the Falkland Islanders themselves, and of course they couldn't get it through Parliament.
And the Argentines then jumped the gun, didn't they?
So the Argentines got fed up. We'd made all these cuts in the Royal Navy in the macro, and in the micro, we'd announced that the Arctic ship Endeavour was no longer required. And they put two and two together and said, well, it's quite clear that if we do something, Britain has no interest in, I mean, they'll huff and puff, but they won't actually do anything by getting back. I think they were genuinely misled.
Now, you say in your book that the Foreign Office did give plenty of warning that withdrawing the survey ship would be taken as this sort of signal. Have you any idea why it was that the Cabinet refused to
take notice? I don't know that they gave plenty of warning. They did make an observation that they would have liked it put back in. But I think it got lost in the small print, so to speak. I mean, the Navy always liked to make the point. I mean, the first thing they put on the list to go is probably the Royal Yacht Britannia or something like that, knowing that somebody will take it out. And then, you know, they'll put in things which they think someone will produce opposition to them to doing, because they think they'll then get support. But the trouble is that the Foreign Office's observation are always very lukewarm, because if they push their luck too much, somebody at the Treasury says, right, you pay for it. And the Foreign Office haven't the slightest intention of doing that.
The other difficulty is that where the Foreign Office is indulging in prediction and futurology, it can never be emphatic, because it's just dangerous to give such hostages to fortune.
To give a hostage to fortune? Yes, I mean, this is, I mean, one of our troubles, one of our worries, one of our complaints about options for change is that nobody's actually said what it is you want the armed forces to do, and what is just as important, what you are not wanting it to do. You see, the trouble is that and that is the right way of doing a thing. The Foreign Office would say, we can accept this option for change plan because we will not wish to do this, this and this, and there's been a decision. But you see, it is no good saying to a government, well, some time ago you took a decision, which means that you can't do the Falkland operation. That would not have been acceptable. The Prime Minister would have said, you've got to do it. We spend a lot of money on defence, you've got to do it. Or at least you've got to try to do it. And one of the troubles with options for change is you've got the financial parameters. You didn't have the Foreign Office saying, look, we are prepared to accept this scheme because we can do A and B, but we can't do C, D, and E, and that we consider that perfectly acceptable. They never do it that way round. And that is why there's always such a case for keeping some sort of general capability, as the Navy always said.
From what you've written, the command machinery actually worked rather smoothly and well during the Falklands campaign.
I thought it worked brilliantly. I mean, I really can't fault it, except on the business of the land forces commander not arriving quite as early as he ought to have been. And he really ought to have been with Woodward when the landing was actually envisaged, and then got ashore really quite quickly after that. But I think I explained why that was. He was needed as an advisor back at Northwood, and of course it wasn't very easy to get him to the Falklands. I mean, the only way to have got him would have been to have parachuted him into the sea. He would have probably been prepared to do that, because I'm sure he was a parachutist as well as being a marine commander. But that was the only way. And that was the only fault, I think. I mean, otherwise, the thing was extremely coherent.
What effect did the loss of the Atlantic Conveyor have on the program?
Well, it had a very serious loss. Of course, it made the Julian Thompson, the commander of the brigade, feel that he wasn't in a position to move forward until Five Brigade had come to relieve him in the bridgehead. Because he'd lost valuable helicopters, and he didn't relish, although the commanders were quite capable of doing it, and the parachute regiment, he didn't relish having to walk his whole force across this enormous expanse of West Falkland. And he lost critical helicopters that would have made all the difference to him. And of course it also meant that they sent their force round by sea with unfortunate results. It needn't have been unfortunate, but it was unfortunate in the loss of the Galahad. So it made an awful effect. But of course the trouble was that the plan, the overall plan, was always that once the bridgehead had been secured and that there was no threat to the bridgehead, to move out of the bridgehead and secure the high ground west of Stanley was always a key part of the plan. And a mixture of the loss of the Atlantic Conveyor and Moore not being there rather held Thompson back. Eventually he did move, but he had to be pushed by the Commander-in-Chief.
It is isn't it generally a marine function to do an amphibious assault, seize a bridgehead and then hold it
for a
short period of time?
Mm.
But that, forces will go
well,
through.
That is right, and that is certainly his Thompson's upbringing and training. But as CGS, I actually made this point when the final plan was agreed with the cabinet, how essential it was to establish superiority over the Argentines immediately after landing and get out of the bridgehead and not get bogged down, remembering some of the earlier operations where people got ashore and then they sat down and they didn't achieve what they wanted to do. And I think Moore understood this, and certainly the Commander-in-Chief understood this. But there was this slight hiatus because Moore... But otherwise, the command machinery worked extremely well, and the Chiefs of Staff machinery worked very well.
Given the unfortunate loss of the helicopters, do you think that the move around to Bluff Cove by sea was a justifiable risk that just happened?
I'm sure I do. I do think it was, and after all, they did move the Scots Guards round in atrocious weather and put them ashore without any casualties at all, although there was very nearly a risk that our frigates would shoot up our own forces because they didn't know about it. But I mean, that was one of these sort of communication errors. But I think if they'd got the Galahad round into the right place, and it was in the wrong bay, if they got them to the right place and they'd got the people off quickly, there wouldn't have been any problem. But it was a mixture of putting them down in the wrong place, having an argument about where the kit was, a shortage of a shortage of landing craft, and then the weather lifting at the wrong moment produced this very unfortunate thing. But it seemed to be the obvious way to do it. I mean, you didn't really want to flog right across 40 or 50 miles when you could move people. But had you had the helicopters, of course, it wouldn't have arisen.
I seem to remember the other problem with not having the helicopters was that casualty evacuation was much more protracted.
Well, I suppose it may have been. All I know is that practically, I don't think any savable person was lost as a result of it. I mean, it was a remarkable achievement. All the casualties were got back. I mean, I don't think anybody who might not have died did die. I think that a mixture of new techniques, new treatment, wonderful naval surgeons at San Carlos, or wherever the hospital was, and then the hospital ships offshore. I think everybody was saved. I didn't realise that there was a tremendous hiatus in that.
Well, I think it's just that if you're having to carry people on stretchers rather than helicoptering them, it just takes much longer.
Well, yes, but they wouldn't have carried them that far.
But even so, with land transport such as there was, it was.
Yes.
But,
well, I mean, nothing goes perfect in war. I mean, the remarkable thing was, I mean, you know, I'm afraid that if you look at the history of war, it's a series of cock-ups, and the chap who wins is the one who makes the least. And I think it was remarkable how well they operated. I mean, considering the distance and the way it was remarkable. And great credit to the task force commander. I mean, I think the actual landing was a brilliant feat, brilliant achievement.
Certainly the case that on the ships on the way down, the soldiers were very, very thoroughly trained in first aid.
Yes.
That was one of the advantages.
I mean, we had a very good first 11 there. I mean, people make remarks about the guards. And I mean, the guards, one has to remember that although at that particular moment they were on public duties, the Welsh Guards had only just come out of a most successful tour in South Armagh. The Scots Guards were a thoroughly tough battalion, and they all had a month's training in Wales. So I think that they were very suited. There was one other battalion, well, two other battalions that we might have sent, and a certain amount of criticism that we didn't. One was the Highlanders, the Seaforth and Camerons, the mixture of Queen's Own Highlanders, who were probably at that moment the best battalion in the British Army, and they were the next to go if we needed anyone else. And the other was the AMF battalion, of course, which we did keep, in case NATO still wanted it. It was our obligation. But, of course, they were trained in Arctic warfare. So that was another one we might have sent. The Gurkhas did very well, and we insisted on sending the Gurkhas, despite Foreign Office objection. And we got, luckily, John Knott and Mrs. Thatcher's support on that. So we had a very good team down there, First 11, absolutely First 11. The parachute battalions were hellish good battalions, and the commander. So, I really do think that considering, I mean, leaving aside the awful thing of the Galahad, our casualties would have been incredibly small, really, considering what was achieved.
Was there at any time a serious consideration of operations against the Argentine mainland?
No, there really wasn't. I think the point was made by bombing Stanley that the Argentines realised that we could bomb Buenos Aires had we wanted to do so. But we didn't want to do so. But the point was made, and I think they were quite.
There might have been a case, might there not, for attacking airfields on the mainland if the Argentine Air Force had been handled with greater force and had been having a greater impact on the airspace over the Falkland Islands.
Well, there might have been, yes. There might have been. And I think this was always in people's mind, that they might launch a raid onto the airfields. But of course, by that time, we were beginning to win our superiority.
I think you've done a very thorough coverage of the Falklands on the in your book on the Chiefs. And also you cover very well the changes made in the procedures, the relationship between the Chiefs of Staff and the Cabinet.
Oh, this is coming along when, yes, that's right.
Lewin's changes in...
That's right, which had occurred, you see, just before the Falklands campaign. But this was the first time... you have to remember, in World War II, Alan Brooke, although he was Chief of the General Staff, was, to all intents and purposes, Chief of the Defence Staff, because he delegated the running of the... to his vice-chief, the running of the army. Yes, could you just... He was really the Chief of Defence Staff in World War II. But after that, of course, it reverted to its true committee system, and even when there was a chairman, he was only empowered to pass on the views of the Chiefs of Staff, and his own if they differed from their collective view. And it wasn't till the reforms that Admiral Lewin brought in, which came into effect just before the Falklands, that we had one Chief of Defence Staff who was the senior advisor to the government, who listened to his other chiefs and took advice from them, but had the full right to give his own views. And this, of course, produced a much more dynamic and coherent leadership during the Falklands.
I think you mentioned that there was frequent contact between not just the Chief of Defence Staff, between the Chiefs of Staff themselves and the Defence Committee that was conducting the...
Yes, and between the Prime Minister. Well, the system was quite a very clear-cut one, very logical one, that the Chiefs of Staff would meet early every morning and would advise the CDS, and indeed get his instructions on their own services, what their own services were capable of, what their own services could produce, organising their own services to meet the common need. And then, fortified with all this knowledge, he would go to the War Cabinet, which would meet later in the morning, and give his advice, clear various things politically, rules of engagement, what extent we were actually at war, what the overall policy was, and then he would either come back to the Chiefs or go direct to Admiral Fieldhouse and say, these are your instructions or orders, your rules of engagement, now get on with it. And that procedure was repeated every day. And then on certain occasions, when the big decisions were to be taken, such as whether we were able to land in the Falklands or not, and when we should do so, then the Prime Minister used to meet with all the Chiefs of Staff, not just the Chief of Defence Staff, either in her room in the House of Commons, or in Downing Street, or at Chequers. And this occurred about four or five times during the campaign.
I think you've said at some point that the Falklands War was a mistake. That be a fair comment?
Well, I mean, I don't think you can just say it was a mistake like that. When it happened, I'm afraid it was extremely necessary. Necessary to make quite certain that every world knew of our obligations to keep our word and look after our interests and so on. But I think it was a mistake in the sense that I feel it was very sad that it ever came to that. I think that there were indications that the Argentinians were getting fed up. I don't think they were prepared to fight a war over it. They certainly didn't have really the resources to do so. And I think that if we had realized that they were about to invade, as I think there were some indications that we ought to have done, we could have sent some sort of force down there which would have made it quite clear that it wasn't going to be worth their while. As it was, we sent them all the wrong signals. And I therefore rather resent the fact that we had to recover the situation in this way and the lives that were lost in so doing. I think we could have made sure that the Argentine invasion never happened. But of course the problem would have still been with us, and we're now solving the problem by remaining wedded to that particular part of the world, and whether that's right I don't know. It's an awful lot of money to spend on a very small output. Many of the people who would be really prepared, given the right amount of money, to resettle somewhere else in the Highlands or in Scotland. And we're stuck there at the moment.
On the other hand, it could be argued that it will give us a stake in Antarctic resources.
Yes, you could argue that. That is perfectly true. It may be a big area of development. You could argue it's still a bit out of our bailiwick, but of course you could argue that.
One might also.
And if there is any oil exploration, I mean, the Argentines would have to want to come in on it. No, I think it was.